Session number 26356, Mr. Jim Bell, Reel 1.
Where and when were you born?
I was born in Kettering in Northamptonshire on the 1st of November 1921. My parents being Richard Arthur Bell, and my mother was Alice Mary Bell. And I stayed there until I was 17 and a half when I joined the army. And in 1939 I joined the regular army and went to the barracks at Northampton.
Right. Well, just to take you back before you whiz on there.
Oh.
Where did you go to school?
Oh, I went to Rockingham Road, Wood Street, and then Stamford Road I finished up at in Kettering. Left at 14.
Were you happy at school?
Yes, to a degree. I didn't do anything school-wise. I had a skill for woodwork, so I could dodge any lessons I like and make the headmaster do to retire the next year, and he'd bought specimen cabinets out of the hospital of solid oak, and I stripped them all down and made them into wardrobes. So my education was shocking. I mean, I had no education at all. So much so when, as I said, when I joined the regular army, I couldn't even pass the elementary exam, so they sent me to school for 6 months until I could pass it.
So did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had two sisters and one brother. I was the senior member of the children. There was exactly 3 years between each of us, funnily enough, which was quite nice. And as I say, my younger brother joined about 3 years after me, well into the war, and he was an infantryman with the 5th North Ants. He was the idea behind it all was that I was going to claim him, which you could in them days, but each time he got near to me, they posted him some other unit in some other country. So I think like we was going up to Rome and he was in Anzio. When we got past Rome, of course, he was in waiting to go to the second front. But, it's quite good.
What did your parents do?
My parents, we had a small off-licensed general grocer's shop on the corner of Mill Road and Wyatt Street in Kettering, North Ants. How that came about, my father was a barman, and we had a local brewery named John Elworthy, who was a very, very nice man, always came round, and we was in tied houses, as it were. And he always came down and inspected, and when another child was born, he'd have more coat hangers put up and things like that. He was a gentleman. But he got pneumonia and died, and Marsden's, Thompson's and Evershed bought the brewery. And my father was given the choice of being made sacked or have one of their off-licences. So we went and looked at this off-licence on the corner. It was a terrible state. An old lady and her daughter, well into her 80s, who'd left the windows open, and the vines and such like had grown into their bedrooms. In the bedroom that we used eventually, you could see through into the street between where the concrete had fallen. It was a hell of a state. First 3-4 weeks, Father and I slept on planks, on empty beer cases, because he wouldn't let anybody, because we had to strip the house. There was about 16 layers of oilcloth on the floor, and oh, what a state. Anyway, we got it round, and it was quite a nice little business. And then when I was 9 years old, Father said, I'm going to start keeping pigs, he said, and then we're going to breed, which I thought was terrific. I didn't realise how much work was involved, going round collecting swill and straw and all this. But, yes, I mean, when I left to join the army, Father was breeding pigs pretty heavily, and he used to get mostly pedigree stock from Bedfordshire, what we used to call Chivers, large white pedigree. Eventually he bought 8 acres of rough, and he had a few wool calves and a couple of hundred hens and 100 ducks and such a little smallholder. You know, although we never had much money, we lived well. I mean, we could always have 2 or 3 eggs for breakfast, which most children couldn't. As I say, then came 39, I joined the army.
You told me earlier that by this time you had your own little car.
Yes, and we was before that we had this little Austin 7, and I went for my test, I think it was December 38, And the night before the test, Father bought a chauffeur-driven Morris 12, I think it was, which I'd never seen. And I was in a blue sweat because no one had got to take a test the next morning. That was quite hilarious because there was a grumpy old examiner in it. From information later gathered, everybody had failed up to me. We get in the car and the engine stalls in the middle of town. And we got out and we was fiddling between the engine, found the choker jammed open, so of course it was over. We got that going. And I remember another time he was going past the flats and he said, "What time is it?" I said, "Got a bloody watch on. Look at your own, don't ask me. I'm driving." And I was as ratty as hell because I thought I'd failed. But eventually when I pulled in, he said, "Yes," he said, "I'm going to pass." He said, "You've got one or two little faults," but he said, "You're all right." And I couldn't believe it because Father went and did a bit more finding out information. Oh, that's right, his hairdresser went that, and he failed as well, and apparently he'd been driving in Ireland, which was quite hilarious, which goes on to the, when I joined the army, like the RSM said, anybody with a driver license? I said, yes, I think it was only about four of us out of about 30 people. I mean, he promptly ripped it up and threw it the length of the square and said, right, you're going to start again. So, yes, it was quite...
So what prompted you to join the army?
I'd always had this thing about me, you know, like most children, want to be a fireman and all that. I wanted to be in the... I wanted to be a Grenadier Guard. I had that so firmly implanted in my brain, I couldn't work it out any other way. And I wanted to go to India. And the more times I put in for India, I never did get to India, and I still haven't been to India, notwithstanding. So, as I was too short for the guards, and that was very particular before the war, I mean, if I'd have waited another 6 months, I would have got it in any case. But so I joined the artillery, and again, they wanted me to be a gunner, and I said, no way am I going to sit in a gun pit, and such like, I want to be a driver. So from day one, I was a driver, so I had to wait several weeks for... I think it was 31 or 32 in a squad. So I had to wait until I got 32 drivers, so you made a driver squad up.
Right, so how did you join up? Did you go to an enlistment centre?
I went to, first of all, to the drill hall in Kettering. And then...
when was this?
This would be September 38. And they interviewed and told me to come back again when I was 17. And I went back again when I was 17. And they measured me and found that I was only 5'8½", I think it was some days, too short. So they told me some exercises to do, and they said, come back 6 months later, which was 1939. So I went back 6 months later, and they checked me, and I was no better, no more. So they said, no, they won't take in the guards. And so a lot, they suggested several regiments, which didn't appeal to me, and all of a sudden, they said, the artillery would be nice. I said, well, I'd somehow be with drivers. He said, well, the artillery want drivers. So I said, right, so I signed up for the artillery.
So what were your thoughts about the impending war at this time?
No thought whatsoever. Never had a clue. I mean, Kettering was a tiny little market town, and there wasn't a lot of information about, you know, there was lots and lots of rumours flying around, but I never thought anything, never once dreamed that there would be a war. I thought, nah, it'll all pass over, the usual thing. And so it didn't bother me when I owed it, because I never thought about it. You know.
What did your parents think about you?
Well, Mother was very upset, because she said, you've got a car and everything, you know, it's as though I was being driven into it. And I said, no, it's no such thing, because it's something I had since I was a child, you know. Being able to go in the forces, you know, to me would have been the crowning point of my glory, to be quite honest with you. I look forward to it so much, you know, until eventually they signed me up and sent me to Northampton for checkups. And then again, I went back to Northampton when I joined up, and they transferred me to the Grand Depot at Woolwich, which was the artillery training centre in them days. There was, to the best of my knowledge, 31 men in a squad. We slept above the stables in barrack rooms, massive barrack rooms. And you weren't allowed to go out on the street until you could walk properly, which was about at least 6 weeks. And even then, all we had issued to us was a boiler suit and a mount, what they called a mounted overcoat, which was a blanket lined short overcoat, especially made for riding horses. But no way did I want to ride a horse. I had no love for them. And eventually, my mother came up to see me at Woolwich, because in them days you could go from Kettering to London for a day trip was 5 shillings return. So she used to come up to see me, and she'd have a two suitcases. One would have cigarettes and such like in, and a couple of bottles of beer. And if anything I could do, then I would. And even then, she tried to talk me out of stopping in the army, because she was quite disappointed in what, I suppose that would be a true description, that it seemed as though I was going downhill going into the army, whereas it was the reverse. I thought it was wonderful. I mean, I was a round-shouldered, willowy lad of 17 and a half when I joined the artillery. And 6 months later, even everybody said, "By God, ain't you a ramrod straight?" And everybody was complimenting me on my figure, you know, the way I walked upright. And you know, of course, you had the old cheese cutter and jacket, and you had your round mess tin and brown leather straps on your water bottle, which was artillery stuff, totally different tools. And I mean, when I joined, there was no talk of gas masks or steel helmets, which you had to carry eventually everywhere you went.
So what did your basic training consist of?
That was everything. You had to go to school every morning for education. Then you would go into the classrooms, and as I was a driver, we had to basically be able to do running repairs when we was driving. They were stripped down differentials, gearboxes, engines. And you did all this, plus you had to satisfy the examiner that you was a competent driver. And I know I did this one day, sloppy signals, and so for 2 hours I had to stand on the square in front of a big mirror doing this. God, I was tired after it. I think I went to bed and slept till next morning. But yes, it was all, you could see eventually it was all designed to train you into being a useful person, and in a way highly skilled, because eventually I was classed as a driver mechanic, which gave me threepence a day extra. But I mean, I could strip an engine down when I was 20 with ease.
What sort of vehicles did you work on?
Well, we in the early days it was mostly Morris's. For driving instruction we had dual controls, and the very old fashioned vehicles. And eventually when war broke out, they used to tell us to go and fetch what they called impress vehicles. So we had all sorts, American, English. I remember driving an American Ford sedan with a truck engine in it, and God, it was powerful. But yes, I mean, in the early days it was basically all Morris's. There was one or two guys, and
what is it, Morris gun tractors, are they?
Yes, there was Morris gun tractors, Morris 1500 weights, a few Humber cars and Humber armoured cars, the scout cars. And then, we had one or two Bren gun carriers, which we thought was fantastic. And we used to go, when I was at Aldershot, we used to go on what they called a half-inch plane and teach other people to drive, which was quite hilarious. I always remember a Lieutenant Rice coming, and we was in at breakfast, and we saw this auburn-haired officer walk down the dining hall and get onto a table, you know, sit up there like a statue. All of a sudden he shouted, "Don Arbell." And then he goes, "Don Arbell." And all of a sudden the bloke says, "Hey, Dinger, that's you." I said, "Don't be bloody silly, I ain't a Donner." I said, "Do you mean me?" So he said, "Yes." So he said, "Take me out onto Laughlin's plane and teach me how to drive." And funny enough, that time it was a Ford 1500 weight, which we'd never liked because it was a high revving engine. And after a while he's pulled up, he said, "You're supposed to be teaching me to drive. Teach me as you would a gunner." And so, of course, the next thing he done, right, I almost broke his arm by belting him. I said, "Bloody well do that, wouldn't he?" Which was quite funny. But later on, when I was posted to Usk Prison, to the 132nd Field Regiment, one of the first jobs I had was teaching all the new militia. I was trying to think of the name, yes, because we used to give them an awful coating with our... We thought it was awful scruffy and such like, because, I mean, that was all Tom, Dick and Harry, you know.
Okay, just take you back to your own enlistment period and training.
Yes.
How did you cope with the discipline after being as a civilian?
First start, very, very difficult. You know, I seem to be ever... Oh, yeah, one thing I could never do, I could never walk alternate arms. I used to swing them both together. Lance Sergeant Hardy. There, I used to scream, get out of the front rank. Of course, as you walked through the middle of Woolwich, I mean, all the sailors were there taking the mickey out of you. After a while, it became quite good fun. You know, you began to realise that somebody was going to take the mickey out of you for the stupid things you was doing. And
did you have regular kit inspections?
Yeah. Oh God, yes. Didn't we just? And the first guard duty I did, you had to be assessed as being suitable for you, was the night of the first trial blackout in London. And so, of course, when we got the guard turned out in the middle of the night, there was no lights or anything. I got all my uniform undone because I'd just fallen off my bed. And it was amazing. But, I'd forgotten all about that until just now. Yes, that was the night of the first blackout in London. So must have been August time before I was suitable for doing a guard duty.
August 1939.
Yes, yes.
And what did you think about your immediate officers, the sergeants and the corporals?
Well, we had a wonderful sergeant, Lance Sergeant Hardy, who was very, very strict and as upright as a ramrod, as we used to say. And yes, he was fantastic. He had some wonderful ways of him. I mean, what we used to say, if somebody did something wrong and we got what we called a bending, that was put through our paces and almost creased us, he would stand by, and the man who caused us that trouble, let us put him in a horse trough and scrub him and then go off back to barracks, you know. And yet he would, although he was watching us, he was in effect turning a blind eye because that was illegal. But I met him on a station many, 2 or 3 years later. He was a straight lieutenant. And I said to Mado, he said, oh, minute war broke out, they immediately promoted me to lieutenant, he said, because of my... He got such a long record of training and everything and service. And one other thing, this may sound silly, but when I went on leave the first time, I wanted to get back. I missed all the lads and the camaraderie and friendship.
Did you make some good friends?
Yes, absolutely. There was four of us, Jim Nines, or McFadgen, a lad from the slums of Glasgow, who came home several times, and we corresponded for years after the war, and then all of a sudden nothing. And I've never been able to find it. Oh, Jim Nines from Birmingham was another one. We were sort of like the four cavaliers together. McFadgen was an awful gambler, and he never seemed to lose. And at times I wondered if he was skilled at card sharping, but I never saw him without money. And he kept the four of us going in them days, you know, he was on 5 shillings a week. And if you imagine a packet of woodbines, I think, was tuppence, so it didn't last very long.
Did you get much chance to go into town in the evenings?
Not a lot, but another thing I remember, there was a ban on going into London, and there was military police on the Woolwich Ferry. So we used to go through the tunnel, walk through the tunnel and go out the other side of the East Ham. I only went to London a couple of times. I suppose I could have gone a lot more, but I don't know. I was so wrapped up in studying and everything. And of course, you spent hours and hours boning your boots so they shone like mirrors, the toe caps and the heels, and burnished the metal edges. Of course, you was iron. You weren't allowed to have an iron, but every barrack room had an iron. And press your suits and everything. And as you said, a kit inspection weekly. I mean, took hours and hours. I mean, we had a bumper the floor the night before the inspection, then lay all our blankets over it so we didn't walk on the floor. It was, it certainly did me a lot of good, because from a willowy, round-shouldered yokel, I became a soldier, or I like to think I did. But
what was the food like?
Very good in them days, because at Woolwich it was civilian people cooking. There was no army catering corps in them days. And, you know, you could go in the evening and it would be a nice plate of fish and chips. Oh yes, one weekend I went in and we had our fish and chips, and I looked down, and all of a sudden this man picked up his plate and smashed it into the man opposite his face. I said, what the hell's the matter to the fellow sitting next to me? You know, he said he called him one of them. I said, What do you mean? He said, you know, he called him one of them. I said, what's that? He said, he called him a bastard. I said, well, what is a bastard? I didn't know. Didn't know from Adam. All of a sudden, the lieutenant and the sergeant major come flying up and parted them. But I don't think anything ever happened in view of what was said. You know, apparently this man did call him a no-good bastard. He probably smashed his plate in his face. I don't remember when the Army Cajun Corps, but I know while I was waiting to go to France with the 10th Field Regiment at Deep Cut, we had ATS cooks, because what, I'd done something wrong and I got 3 days CB and I volunteered to work in the kitchen, and there was this massive ATS sergeant who seemed to take a shine to this little shy lad. And so I used to go peeling potatoes and everything, and she always made sure I had a good supper for her left foot. She was very sweet, really, but she was massive to me. She was at least 7 foot tall. But yeah, we had some gale times, because I mean, there used to be on the parade ground at 6 o'clock in the evening, there was close on 100 people on pickle duty, ordinary guard, and vehicle what's walking around, and everything. It was quite hilarious, because as I say, it was at Deep Cut where I first time I ever rode a motorcycle, and I always remember the sergeant saying, can you ride a bike? I said, no, I've never ridden a motorbike. So my father used to have one, and he taught me to ride a motorcycle on the footpath or the towpath of the Basingstoke Canal. And his remarks were, go to the right and you'll be in the bloody water. Go to the left and you'll be in the Major's Guard. Whichever way it is, you'll be in bloody trouble. Which was quite a lot.
What type of bike was that?
Well, that was...
Would it be a BSA N20?
I think it was a 500 Norton, the old Knocker Norton. Mm-hmm. Eventually we had AJs and Deezers. Mm-hmm. But my favourite was the 500 Norton. I used to love rough, as we used to call it, rough riding. We used to go over a half-inch plane and such like, skylarking about quite often. To me, the Knocker Norton was the bike, because it was, the underneath was higher than any other bike, so you could, the rougher the terrain, the better it was. Until the end of the war, when we got all, some of the German two-strokes, which was very, very nice bikes. As I say, we was all ready to go to France. I was with the 10th Field Regiment, that I recall.
And so your training, how long did your actual training take then?
Oh, I started training in March. I think it was early September when I got shipped down to Deep Cut.
So war had broken out by this time?
Yes, yes.
So what were you told about what was happening?
Very little. I don't recall much being said, you know, other than the fact I was waiting to go to France. The regiment was made up of basically what you could call odds and sods, because we got the old wheel drivers in putty and riding breeches and spurs and putties, and there was us in jackets and trousers and the water tent, and then it seemed to be everybody got a different dress on. It wasn't quite like that, when you saw a parade ground with half the men in breeches and putties and spurs and the other half in trousers, it looked most peculiar.
So you went to Deep Cut as a... You passed out as a private,
yes,
a driver.
Yeah, a driver. And they were so short of barracks at the time, we slept in the married quarters. There was half a dozen of us to a bedroom. You know, you filled your palliasse with straw and bedded down to the best of your ability. Then... I don't recall.
Did you do any more training while you were at Deep Cut?
Yeah, it was all to do with the brain guns and things, you know, which you hadn't encountered at Deep Cut, at Woolwich, because there, I mean, it was a Lee Enfield rifle and a cane, which they used to call it a whip, or they used to say downstairs with rifles and canes for your drills. You were taught to walk with a cane properly and hold it parallel.
And what sort of infantry pace did you march at?
Much, much slower than the infantry. Was it 122 a minute, I think? There wasn't a great deal in them days of emphasis on marching, because we was either in gun tractors or, in my case, I lived and died on a motorcycle, but I could drive. I had a certificate which entitled me to teach anyone to drive in any vehicle, tractor or wheeled. It was only in the last 2 years I got rid of my book on the 1939 version of Army Vehicles Tractor Wheeled, which was quite a useful book on all engines and everything. It was my oldest book. Yes, the...
So you've been told at Deep Cut that you were going to go to France?
Oh, yes, yes. It was, you know, quite... I didn't... Never even entered my head about my age. As I say, out of the blue, we appeared on parade one morning and they had this list of... I think there was 18 of us, to be correct. They shared out and told to fall out, which we did. And, hey presto, we were shipped down to this prison in Monmouthshire. The prison had been turned over to a barracks for the 132nd Field Regiment, 321 Battery and 322 Battery. And we had the spiders of the cells as barracks. And when we got there, we were thoroughly disgusted with it because it was a territorial unit. I think the RSM was 73 years old, so you can tell what it was like. It was all jacks and what's that. Their guns was four... For the whole regiment was four drill purpose 4.5 howitzers. They had about six Morris vehicles for the tow-in. From somewhere or other, we had about 20 impressed cars, all different makes, but sprayed with khaki. And although I say it myself, we 18 was the only one who knew how to march and do rifle drill and centrico drill. And they hadn't got rifles till we got there, so they had 18 rifles suddenly. And very, very slowly, in the winter of 39, I had something like an Austin 16 or a Morris 16. And I used to take the men to the dentist at Newport every day, but it was a wicked winter and the roads was like ice. Quite often you used to spin around and people would be screaming and shouting and doing the nut, as we used to say. And of course, to us it was one big giggle because at 17 and a half, I mean, just going on 18, it was hilarious, you know. And,
so the rest of the chaps you trained with had gone off to France, had they?
Yes, oh yes. I don't know how true it was, but afterwards... when they came back from Dunkirk and such like, someone said, "Oh, what was your regiment, mate?" I said, "Well, it used to be in the 10th. Oh, Christ," he said, "they was wiped out in France." Mm. Now, how true that was, I don't know, because you had so many rumours and hearsay comments flying around, you know. We spent quite a long time going down to the docks at Newport and I think Cardiff too, bringing all the survivors from Dunkirk and such like, you know, there was filthily dirty, half-dressed, and there would be arms and ammunition. We had to sell it all covered in sand, and, I mean, there was grenades and rifles, all useless, but...
What effect did that have on you, seeing the men?
Quite a shock, actually. You know, the... we quickly realised if the Germans had known then what we were knowing, if he'd have attacked us, we couldn't have done a thing. We hadn't got anything, because we used to take all these arms and grenades and everything off the people and bath them and give them a clean kit. But that's about all we had. I mean, it would have been, we would never have lasted. I don't think we'd have lasted very long, because everything was lost. We didn't have it. But those, the Lord must have smiled on us, because nothing happened. Because the next thing we had delivered to us some American 75mm, copied off the French 75 with these massive great iron bound wheels, and we used to go through the towns and villages in the middle of the night, and clank, clank, clank. People used to turn out in their night dresses and everything, looking at us and wondering. And eventually...
Where were you going? Were you doing manoeuvres?
Well,
or?
Yeah, we was allegedly called a flying column, which was in case any parachutists or anything like that landed. We, on one occasion, the officer gave a signal to move off, of which we did, and went down through the towns at a rate of knots, doing about 50 miles an hour with these guns going. Like, what he meant was he was going on his own, stay ready, but of course it was too late. We followed him, but eventually... they gave us an order and we went up to Liverpool, somewhere on the outskirts of Liverpool, to an ordnance factory, and they fitted balloon tyres on these 75mm, which was quite nice. I mean, you at least could drive at quite 50 miles an hour They bothered, whereas at 50 miles an hour with the iron bound wheels, and they used to jump all over the road. But and then, I mean, we only had 1,500 weights. We hadn't, wasn't until we got the 25 pounders, we got kitted out with gun tractors. There was Morris, Guy, no Chevs, the Lorries were Chevs. I think that was all the gun tractors. There was two types of Morris, the underslung.